rationale for developing a national anti-missile system is to undercut other nations' nuclear deterrence so that we would have a free hand to get involved in other nations militarily to attack other nations.
It is not just a paranoid speculation. It is actually a circumstantially and directly documented fact of U.S. strategic doctrine and policy that we have always reserved the right to strike first with nuclear weapons.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the Weekly Freak Show for Sunday, December 16th, 2001. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this one-hour examination of the news and events not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, Antonia Juhas of the International Forum on Globalization discusses passage of fast-track legislation. Jeff Perlstein of Media Alliance on the value of an independent press. And later, we'll explore a Bush administration decision to withdraw from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. We'll hear from Luke Warren of the Council for a Livable World and Peter Lumsdaine, coordinator of the Vandenberg Action Coalition. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show coming up next. On December 6th, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Presidential Trade Promotion Authority Bill, granting President Bush sweeping powers to negotiate trade agreements. Dubbed Fast Track, the bill dramatically shifts constitutionally mandated powers of Congress to the executive branch. The contentious measure passed the House by a one-vote margin in what congressional watchdogs have described as a highly irregular vote. With us to talk about this and other trade-related issues is Antonia Juhas, Project Director for the San Francisco-based International Forum on Globalization. Antonia directs several of the forum's programs, including those on alternative models of globalization, the globalization of water, and key aspects of trade policy. She begins by explaining the legislation passed last week.
Fast Track is a mechanism that allows presidents to negotiate international trade deals in a way that essentially cuts the traditional democratic process out. It cuts Congress almost completely out of the process by eliminating the traditional committee process by which a bill comes to Congress. It goes to the committee where the members of Congress who are experts on that issue, whether it's issues of economic well-being or food and agriculture, investment issues, finance issues, trade issues. The bill comes to that committee, and that's where the members of Congress get to look really closely at the bill and truly understand it. They bring in experts to listen to about the bill and then decide whether they think the bill should move forward. That process is wiped out completely. Then members of Congress are only allowed a limited amount of time to debate the legislation. Again, for people who aren't familiar with how Congress really works, the debate, often if you watch on C-SPAN, for example, and you watch members of Congress on the floor debating a bill, it looks pretty pointless because generally there's nobody else on the floor with them. They're talking to an empty room, and you wonder why they're doing it at all. Well, what they're doing is they're talking to TV cameras, and the members of Congress and their staff are sitting in their offices, and they're watching the debate in their office. And they pay very close attention to that debate to learn more from the members who know more about a bill than they do, and also to get a general political idea of who is for and against legislation. And that debate is cut off under Fast Track. And then finally, and most importantly, the sort of core element of how democratic processes work, the ability to amend legislation to make sure that it works well for each member of Congress's constituency, who they represent, why they're there, is completely eliminated, so you can't amend legislation. While it may sound less important to the average listener that this mechanism only impacts what are called international trade and investment agreements, international trade and investment has grown to encompass absolutely every single form of public law that we have, everything from how we provide social security checks to how we deal with farmers, to how we deal with workers, to how we take care of our environment. It really has become the meat and potatoes of legislation. This fast-track authority that the president got a yes vote on in the House last week allows him to essentially sweep through Congress legislation that would alter all of our most basic laws.
Now, this was a really close vote, 215 to 214. Why would Congress grant the president authority to take away their power.
Why would they give them the yes vote? Well, the truth is that fast track is a new idea. It's only been around since Nixon in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And it's only been used a few times, and it's only been used on the most contentious of legislation in its most recent usages, or for the creation of the World Trade Organization and the creation of the North American Free Trade Agreement. And since that time, since the last use of fast track, no president has been able to regain that authority. President Clinton tried twice to regain that authority, and the Congress turned him down twice because, essentially, members of Congress had learned that trade agreements are not quite as innocuous as the term sounds like, and that they impact all the things that all members of Congress need to be in control of. And so this time around, very surprisingly, the Congress granted President Bush fast-track authority by one vote. And there are a whole bunch of reasons why that vote ended up the way it did. Until the very last minute when they even decided to have the vote, it was clear that the president was probably going to lose, that he wasn't going to get enough votes to pass fast-track. But they decided to go ahead with the vote anyway, because usually on votes that are this contentious, some members of Congress don't actually reveal their positions until they're forced to on the floor. So they said, let's go ahead and go for it. And then what happened was some of the most dirty politics that I've observed in a long time as someone who used to work on Capitol Hill and has been working in and around it for a very long time, which is essentially the Republicans pulled out all the plugs and arm-twisted as far as they could, making deals left and right. One White House official told Congress Daily, you won't believe how much money we spent in the last 2 hours, in the last 2 hours before the vote. They essentially gave away the farm, literally, to get members of Congress to vote for the bill. But then, when the time ran out on the vote, they hadn't had enough votes. They hadn't won. The House had voted against fast track. So then, they let the clock keep ticking, which is against the rules, and kept the vote open until they had given away enough goodies that they got two members to actually switch their votes from no's to yes, and got some members who were hoping that they wouldn't have to vote, and as soon as the vote went one up in their favor, the gavel came down and the vote was closed. Most importantly, what they gave away to get members to vote in favor of fast track was they promised members of Congress from textile heavy states that essentially they would protect them from trade agreements that we have already signed. So they said that they would renege on the provisions of trade agreements we have already signed, and that they would renege on promises that we made several weeks ago in Qatar at the World Trade Organization. So basically what you've got is the United States running around promising countries that will do one thing, then promising the members of Congress that it will do another thing, all just to get the votes to go the way we want to go. And so the Bush administration got fast track last week, and they got the new negotiating round of the World Trade Organization 2 weeks before that. But essentially both wins are based on promises which are opposite to each other. They are based on lies. And we'll see, you know, how those lies play out in the opinion of the public and of other countries on how the United States stands on trade agreements in the future.
So essentially, under NAFTA and under deals like FTAA, which has not yet gone through, but most likely will if this fast track passes in the Senate, there are, you mentioned these hearings and trials. There, now, I just want to make it clear to our listeners, those are before basically secret judges, essentially.
Yes. They're called tribunals. But first of all, I wouldn't say that if the Senate gets fast track, passes fast track, that therefore these trade deals will go through. Because while it is a terrible loss, if the president does end up getting fast track, we should never assume that we have lost altogether, because the vote still has to go back through the Congress, and you know, many members of Congress simply don't understand trade legislation and its impacts, and we should never stop educating them and making sure they understand so that when the vote finally does happen, that we can still win. But in any case, these cases do not get heard in domestic courts. Rather, they go to a tribunal that is set up with only trade experts, trade lawyers as the judges. And those judges don't have to face any of the regular legal restrictions that we have to do in the United States. For example, they can have conflict of interest. There's been many cases where a judge has sat on a NAFTA tribunal and the outcome of the case directly impacts their own business interests. And that has been okay. There's no friend of the court briefs, which means that if you're not a direct party to the suit, which would only be the United States government and the Canadian government and the Methanex Corporation, not even the state of California, under the formal rules, is a party to this suit, and even they could not explain their interests and their impacts, much less the citizens groups in California who actually pushed to get the Methanex ban passed. Also, the standards are only based on, that the tribunal makes their decisions on, are only what increases trade and what doesn't, not what is good for our communities and what is good for our health. And that's in the bottom line where the entire agenda is completely flawed, because rather than a system of checks and balances, you know, where there are some people advocating for trade and some people advocating for the environment, some people advocating for business, you only have one message, and that is what will push trade forward. And therefore, every tribunal that's ruled on a NAFTA case, or for that matter, cases under the World Trade Organization, has ruled in favor of increasing trade rather than protecting health or the environment or workers.
Now, developing countries complain that they have yet to benefit from previous WTO deals, and they were instrumental in 1999 at the WTO talks in Seattle in helping those talks fall apart, and as well, I believe it was Venezuela who pulled out of the FTAA summit.
Yeah, and Brazil.
And Brazil. Can you talk about how these so-called third world or developing, or the global south, how the nations in the global south are affected by this? Like, how do these trade deals essentially deny protections for environmental, labor, and human rights laws?
Well, the impact of World Bank and International Monetary Fund policies that essentially did the same thing in developing countries that the World Trade Organization and agreements like the North American Free Trade Agreement and the Free Trade Area of the Americas are doing in other countries. The impact on developing countries has been the strongest, or the greatest impact thus far, because essentially they are being told through the trade agreements and through the World Bank International Monetary Fund how their governments can and cannot behave to protect their citizenry or their environment. Essentially, there's just a list of things you can and cannot do. And anything that would be restrictive to the entrance of businesses or investment dollars is a no-no. And anything that opens you up more fully to trade and to business is something you can do. And so in developing countries around the world, the impact has been essentially de-development or even moving backwards, because governments aren't allowed to do the things they need to do to foster local business, to protect the environment while developing, to protect workers. I mean, everything that from as straightforward as the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, saying specifically to governments, you have to reduce and limit your union protection laws. You have to reduce your minimum wages. You have to cut money to your environment bureau. You have to reduce environmental legislation. You're specifically telling governments that that's a condition of receiving loans. To the World Trade Organization, for example, under the agricultural agreement, telling governments you cannot create price support systems that make sure that local farmers are able to actually make money off of their harvest. You cannot protect land to make sure that it only goes to local farmers. You have to open up land. You have to open up your markets to cheaper imports from developed countries, even if that hurts your own people and makes them starve. The impact of World Trade Organization policies in countries like India and Ethiopia has been astounding. Those are countries that are actually food exporters. They export more food than they bring in, yet they also have enormous starving communities because they're exporting food to meet the guidelines of World Trade Organization policies, International Monetary Fund, World Bank policies. The impact is that the food's going out, but there's no money coming in, so people who are growing the food are not making money. They're not having any food to eat themselves because the food's being exported, and you see more and more hungry and landless and homeless people as a result. And really, the bottom line is restricting governments from doing the things they need to do to protect their own population.
The International Forum on Globalization recently released a report, Does Globalization Help the Poor? Can you talk about what the report found and how this was conducted?
Yeah, our report, Does Globalization Help the Poor, that we just put out, is an attempt to put together essentially a series of indexes, somewhat like the Harper's Index, in a very easy-to-read format of quotes drawn as much as possible from very mainstream sources, even pro-globalization sources like the World Bank and the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency and the London School of Economics and sources like those. Under headings such as the impact on social services, the impact on labor, the impact on health, and taking quotes from those sources and looking at how globalization impacts people around the world within these categories. And the sources and the quotes unanimously reached the conclusion that the policies of economic globalization of the type put forward by the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the like, are not only harming the poor in developing countries, but they're harming the poor in the developed world, and they're harming everyone except for a very small cadre of people who are getting wildly wealthy at the expense of the majority of the people, and not to mention the planet. And essentially, it's just a series of quotes to make it very useful for activists and the media and anyone else who's interested in reading it to really get a good grip on these difficult questions, but in a pretty straightforward manner.
Where can listeners find the report?
They can order the report on our webpage, which is www.ifg.org, and it costs $12. They can also call at 415-561-3480 to order the publication.
And lastly, for folks who are concerned about Fast Track, what action would you recommend they take at this time?
At this point, the best thing to do is go to Public Citizen's webpage, which is www.citizen.org, to find out how your member voted and contact them and either tell them that you support them or don't support them for that vote, because it could come around again. And then call your senator, because it hasn't gone to the Senate yet, and tell them how you think that they should vote. And finally, the most important thing is to really just spread education and talk to everyone you know about what Fast Track is and its impact, because believe me, the vast majority of the people don't know and don't know how greatly it does impact them.
Jeff Perlstein is executive director of the San Francisco-based Media Alliance, a 25-year-old nonprofit training and resource center for media workers, community organizations, and political activists, whose mission is ethics, diversity, and accountability in all aspects of the media, in the interests of peace, justice, and social responsibility. Jeff Perlstein also co-founded the Independent Media Center in November 1999. He spoke with Freak Radio's Old Lady Scararms about the importance of independent journalism.
IndieMedia.org is a website that really is kind of a hub for the organizing of these various networks of independent media makers that are international in scope. And, you know, I always try to make a point to acknowledge that these networks existed well before Indie Media kind of bubbled on the scene in 1999. But one thing that hadn't happened is that a lot of these different organizations in different locales and these networks of video teams and audio teams, etc., hadn't really made a strong use of the web. They hadn't really seized upon a way to use the web for powerful distribution yet. And especially, you know, a lot of these media makers who are working for social justice are doing it in their volunteer time, didn't have a lot of resources to be working on distribution. So the idea was specifically to use the WTO protests in 1999 in Seattle as an opportunity to pull all these different media makers together through one kind of portal, one site that would be able to distribute their information globally. It's quite a radically participatory project as it's conceived and as it operates in a lot of ways. There's no staff. It's still an all-volunteer project after 2 years. But after 2 years with no staff, there's over 65 media centers in over 13 countries around the world. And, you know, another kind of astounding example, I think, of the power of these networks and the power of the participatory model that we use to create the project is that the website during the week of the WTO protests got more visits than CNN's website. And that's without any advertising. That's really due to one word of mouth and the linking of all these different social networks that were converging around defending, you know, the planet, defending the concerns of workers, defending the concerns of our communities. But also it is a testament, too, to the strength of the site as well, because one of the main features is that anyone can post a story to it. So this is really going back to providing spaces for underrepresented communities, underrepresented voices to be heard, to have their concerns articulated in their own voices, which is a very powerful practice. And so, you know, when folks go to the site, if they're able to visit it, they'll see that they have the opportunity by just kind of cutting and pasting or just printing in some text to break down this distinction between who is a journalist and who is not. Everyone can participate and make their media, have their voices represented. And the site also was one of the first kind of all-volunteer independent media projects that had streaming audio and video as well. So it was really quite an engaging site, and also was having, you know, up-to-the-minute information. So during the protests, for example, we were having, you know, 300 to 400 postings an hour of different stories. We had over 500 volunteers out in the streets. So we were able to scoop a lot of the stories that, you know, CNN with their team of five, or, you know, ABC with their team of six, just weren't able to get to.
Or weren't interested in.
Or weren't interested in, yeah, that's right. So, yeah, so I think it's quite a powerful project, and it continues to grow and continues to seek the participation of others. So people should really, if they're interested, check it out.
You're a media activist, obviously. Can you just give me your perspective on the importance of media activism and your thoughts on the mainstream press?
You know, media is, as we all know, in this day and age, an absolutely crucial aspect of our everyday existence. Our environment is completely influenced by the media, whether that's TV, if you don't have a TV, that's by billboards, walking around, you know, newspapers, and even if you're not consuming any of those sorts of media, the people around you most likely are. So we're all affected by this information overload in some ways. And it's absolutely crucial for us to be challenging these systems. There's all sorts of systems that impact us on a daily basis. You know, there's the government, there's media, and, you know, I think we need to be challenging all of those to be in the public interest. And for us to be participating in them. You know, one thing that Media Alliance is particularly focused on is media organizing, because there are groups out there who are quite strong and quite good at doing media analysis, and that's, you know, an important step to awareness. But Media Alliance is really focused on, once we have the analysis, where do we go from there? What are we going to do about it now? And how are we going to build a sense of democracy that includes media democracy? We haven't struck upon the final answer for that, but we're hoping to come to that conclusion, that answer, and build our strength and power in concert with all the good folks out there and who are listening, and all the good folks around the country and around the world who really are recognizing the need to claim our own voices, to confront corporate power, and to assert, you know, the power of people and our communities.
If we can't communicate to people, we're not going to be able to reach them. And this is about that, and about what they're not telling us, why we need shows like Democracy Now! You'd think I'm really trying to ingratiate myself with the staff of Democracy Now!, but, and it's true, but... The CIA is pushing crack in the ghettos of L.A. while the food crops in Colombia get sprayed by the DEA. The FBI is reading your email with something called the carnivore. While the rich are getting richer and the poor are staying poor, they're launching nuclear-powered ships up into space. One little accident could wipe out half the human race. They're putting radioactive waste into your silverware, or maybe your toaster, or perhaps your wheelchair. The Air Force is bombing Iraq every other day. They don't like the government, so the children have to pay. And the ozone hole is growing, the sheep are going blind, while the U.S. spends more on arms than the rest of the world combined. Journalists are getting fired from San Jose to Atlanta when they write about reality, not a fluff piece for Fanta. A death threat every week, and sometimes life is short when the truth is too dangerous for someone to report. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? The cancer rates are skyrocketing, though people are smoking less. If you live near a nuke, your life is bound to be a mess. Clean water's almost gone all over the earth, and what's left they want to privatize and see how much it's worth. Chevron is gunning down the students of Nigeria, turning the land to waste while the babies die of diphtheria. And the temperatures are rising, the world's forests are on fire. Pretty soon Brazil will be one raging funeral pyre. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country. And then they make the news. Is it media or mind control? Heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? One in three adult Americans cannot read or write, and their children go to bed hungry every night. 2 million U.S. citizens are rotting behind bars, and while they're there, they're working hard, building parts for cars. The Army's running torture schools to keep the earth under control, and they're relocating Navajos so they can mine some extra coal. Our taxes pay McDonald's to sell tumors in Shanghai, while 100,000 poison vets are just about to die. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control? Heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? And the people are resisting wherever you may go. And this is the single biggest fact they don't want you to know. From New Delhi to New Mexico, there are battles going on. And the darkest hour is just before the dawn. In Berkeley and New York, they're raiding radio stations, trying to turn the voice of the people into the voice of the corporations. Will we seize the airwaves, wipe the sweat off of our brow, stand and face the beast and shout democracy now? Who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control? Heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? That we're living in these times? That we're living in these times.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, you're tuned to the Weekly Freak Show on Radio Left, progressive radio for people who care at www.radioleft.com. Please have a pen and paper ready to take down our contact information at the end of this one-hour broadcast. That was David Rovix with this week's Spotlight Sound, Who Will Tell the People, from his most recent CD, Living in These Times. Buy it online at www.davidrovix.com. The Bush administration is moving forward to construct a Reagan-era-style missile defense system referred to as Star Wars. The multi-billion dollar plan, proponents say, will defend the United States from a sneak attack by so-called rogue states. Supporters of the Star Wars program have been bolstered by news that on December 3rd, a mock warhead launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California was shot down 140 miles over the Pacific Ocean in what Pentagon officials have termed an important achievement for the deployment of a missile defense system. The Bush administration has been vocal about its commitment to the rapid pursuit of Star Wars and moving beyond the ABM Treaty. But strong opposition has been expressed by Russia, China, and many European Union nations who fear that the Star Wars program will spark a new arms race. Russia has threatened to tear up nuclear arms control agreements if the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty is broken to allow national missile defense to proceed. The president defended his push for a missile shield during a national security speech on December 11th at the Citadel in South Carolina. For the good of peace, we're moving forward with an active program to determine what works and what does not work. In order to do so, we must move beyond the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty, a treaty that was written in a different era for a different enemy, Bush said. An official announcement on the decision to withdraw from the ABM treaty came 2 days later on December 13th, the same day that a $10 million prototype booster rocket for the Star Wars system went off course during a test. Just before the U.S. announced its withdrawal from the ABM Treaty, I spoke with Luke Warren, analyst, and media coordinator at the Council for a Livable World, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank. He begins with a brief description of how the Star Wars system would work.
Basically, this is a child of Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative that started in 1983, and it's gone through various forms since that time. The latest version, what we call National Missile Defense, is still kind of under review by the Bush administration as to how it's going to be configured, but the general premise now is to create a system that can intercept a few missiles from either an accidental launch or from a rogue, a nation, or a terrorist group that might get its hands on ballistic missiles armed with nuclear weapons and so on and so forth. So it's a little bit smaller in scope, but they're, right now I guess they're looking to intercept, you know, initially about 20 missiles, 20 to 25 missiles.
And how does this work?
It does this by essentially the various radar systems at various places, infrared as well as, you know, your traditional radar. And this question whether they'll put satellites in space that can track this stuff or not, they are working on those kinds of systems. So it'll definitely be ground-based radar systems, and they will transmit that information to wherever the missile defense site is located right now. That looks to be Alaska. And it will send that information to the interceptor missiles, which will then launch using that radar information and attempt to intercept the target missiles in space. So that is kind of during what they call the mid-course phase, while the ICBMs, the missiles, have dropped their boosters, but they're kind of in space, and that's before they re-enter the atmosphere.
From my understanding, when they do a test, they fire a rocket from Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshall Islands in the South Pacific?
That is correct. The target missile comes from California, and the interceptor is launched from Kwajalein and intercepts somewhere about 140 or so miles in space over the Pacific Ocean. It's kind of interesting because that's the exact opposite direction from which we're thinking the missiles might come. So it's kind of backwards. In any event, you know, I guess this is primarily for safety reasons. If they miss, they don't want the missile, you know, the target missile coming back down on U.S. soil, so they kind of shoot it into the Pacific.
So the test on December 3rd was the fifth such test of this program?
That is correct. The fifth full, like, intercept test.
Okay.
You know, they do subcomponent tests here and there, but as far as the actual hit-to-kill technology for a national anti-missile system, this was the fifth test.
Now, the reports I've read since December 3rd, they're calling this a success. Is that your position? Do you think this test was a success?
Well, the problem is how you define success. Certainly there was an intercept, but people reading that, say just skimming the headlines, they might make that out to think that we can actually intercept an enemy missile that's launched at us, and that's certainly not the case. You have to realize that this test had limited objectives, and the main objective was to see if all the subcomponent parts of the systems work well together and whether or not they can actually get the interceptor to launch, separate from the booster, and actually hit the target. But the target missile has a radar beacon on it that's kind of telling the interceptor, here I am. So in that sense, it's entirely unrealistic. If you were to take that radar beacon away, there would not have been an intercept because we do not have the radar systems right now capable of determining the difference between a missile or a decoy in space, you know, much less even find the missile. So, yeah, it's a success. And the Pentagon, I think, is being honest by saying, look, this is, you know, just a baby step, and we're going to make these tests more realistic as time goes on. But proponents of this system are going to argue that, you know, yes, look, see, we have the technology, we can do this. That's not the case at the moment.
And now how much does each one of these missile tests cost?
About $100 million.
$100 million each?
Yes.
Each time. In your view, is it worth that price from the technology?
I mean, considering that this is really just kind of like early stage test. It's an awful lot of money, and I think it gives a good scale as to what kind of money is going to be required to actually do full-scale testing of this system, realistic testing. You know, the Bush administration is talking about sea-based systems and putting weapons in space and space radar systems, and all this is going to cost a vast amount of money. And, you know, if a simple test costs $100 million, you can imagine how much the entire system will cost.
With the events of 9/11 almost 3 months ago now, it pretty much showed that, you know, an attack on the United States doesn't necessarily have to be a long-range missile. Is it your view that the deployment of a Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative, call it what you will, is the deployment of this program really going to stop a rogue state or an enemy from attacking the United States? I think the events of 9/11 have showed that it won't, but I'm curious what your position is.
our position is that the attack on 9/11 is something that we have been stating for a long time as the real threat to U.S. security. No particular nation, definitely nations, are not going to attack the United States with a ballistic missile. That leaves a return address, we would retaliate, and the attacking nation would then be annihilated. You know, and that's why we have nuclear deterrence. On the other hand, a terrorist attack is something that's very hard to predict. They're hard to detect, and they're hard to retaliate against because we don't always know where they're coming from. So they're cheap, they're easy, they're not high-tech. You know, anybody can pull one off, grab a couple of suicide bombers, and you've got yourself a terrorist attack.
Recently, President Bush met with Russian Premier Vladimir Putin. What came out of these talks, and do you see a possible weakening of the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty in the works?
I was very disappointed by what happened in the Crawford Summit. It looked like there was going to be an agreement between Bush and Putin, basically something along the lines of the U.S. would agree to stay within the anti-ballistic missile treaty as long as Putin kind of looked the other way on some of the tests that the U.S. is interested in doing that would violate the ABM treaty. You know, there's also probably some talk about Putin would look the other way. The U.S. wouldn't actually deploy a system, and we wouldn't pull out of the ABM treaty. That's what we were looking at. We were also looking at cuts in the U.S. nuclear arsenal, which Bush did announce, but Bush didn't want to put anything on paper, so that kind of killed, you know, the whole deal. And this is not surprising on my end, but and that's because I really think that Bush's desire not to have anything on paper is just an extension of his unilateralist foreign policy. Even after 9/11, the Bush administration looked like they were going to start embracing more kind of multilateral internationalist viewpoints on foreign policy and, you know, looking to try to get as many nations together as possible on this war on terrorism and so on and so forth. But even then, there was some kind of underlying, you know, evidence. There was underlying evidence that Bush is still very much a unilateralist. I think the desire to not have anything in writing in terms of arms control treaties is just that. It's Bush's desire not to be constrained by a treaty to another nation, and it gives the United States the ability to kind of do whatever they want. And that's obviously not the proper way to go. I think Putin was right in insisting on something be written on paper, and that's why the deal broke down. So I really put the fault here at Bush's feet, not Putin's. It's unfortunate something didn't happen. But, you know, that's not to say that, you know, in the next few months they won't get something together. So, you know, I'm still hopeful that they'll come to some kind of mutual understanding on this that would maintain the ABM treaty but allow the United States to do some more robust testing, basically, of this type of technology.
What is the link, in your view, between military domination and economic domination around the planet?
You mean just in terms of the United States?
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a link insofar that you have to be strong economically in order to have a dominant military. A military costs excessive amounts of money, as we've seen by the fact that one of these tests costs $100 million. I mean, since the late 50s, the United States has spent $150 billion on various anti-missile efforts, and we have nothing to show for it. We have a military budget that for next year, 2002, is going to be $343 billion. This is three times more than the amount of money that Russia, China, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Libya, Cuba, Sudan, and North Korea spend on their militaries combined. And the nations that spend the most on the militaries, other than the United States, are our NATO allies. So we have, with all of our allies, about 80% of the world's military budgets. But our allies are generally the nations that have money. So this is, obviously, the two go hand in hand. You can't buy a good military if you don't have the money. Now, economic domination in itself is another issue entirely, and that can be, you know, brought about by other means. But that's more or less controlled by U.S. corporations, not necessarily by the federal government. So I don't know how much role the federal government has in that. But as far as the military, yeah, I mean, the United States military is designed to be, you know, the world's policeman. And I think part of the rationale for developing a national anti-missile system is to undercut other nations' nuclear deterrence so that we would have a free hand to get involved in other nations militarily to attack other nations, or if something was to happen, to give the United States a free hand to go in and use whatever military force it wants without fear of retaliation by a nuclear weapon.
You mentioned China and Russia and some other nations. China has worded some strong opposition to the deployment of this program. Do you see this Star Wars, SDI, call it what we will, as a new arms race in the works?
I don't think anybody can compete with the United States at this point in a true arms race, unlike during the Cold War. But I do see Russia maintaining more nuclear weapons than they can probably afford and taking money away from other elements of their budget, which desperately need the money. And I also see Russia potentially deciding to undercut the U.S. national anti-missile system by selling a lot of their nuclear technology or missile technology to places like North Korea and China. I definitely see it kind of creating an arms race with China, but again, I don't think China really wants to build thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons. I think it would force them to build maybe 50 to 100 more than they're planning to do. But right now, they only have 20 that are capable of hitting the United States. Personally, I would like to see that number maintained. But it looks like China is going to beef that number up, largely in response to the U.S. efforts to build this anti-missile system. So, yeah, there's an arms race in a way. But, you know, if countries are really gung-ho about attacking the United States with a nuclear weapon, they're just going to put it in the hull of a ship and sail it over here. They're not going to launch it by a ballistic missile. That's just ludicrous. It's suicidal. Nobody's going to do that. So I don't think these nations can afford to get into an arms race with the U.S. It's just going to force the arms race in a different direction that's cheaper for them and harder for us to detect.
Lastly, if you were in a position of power in the military, would you recommend that this program be carried forth, or would you say it should be scaled back or scrapped completely?
I would probably curtail the testing and research on these national anti-missile systems to a bare minimum. If I would to put effort anywhere, it would be on what they call theater anti-missile systems. Systems are designed to shoot down Scud-type missiles, medium, short-range type missiles, generally not exo-atmospheric, and missiles that a lot of countries have and generally use with conventional warheads. So you don't really have an arms race type of question here, certainly not a nuclear arms race. These systems can protect our forward-deployed troops. We really wouldn't need them here, back here at home, to defend America, because one of these systems wouldn't, say, have shot down the jets that were used in 9/11. No anti-missile system could do that. But they would be useful deployed overseas, you know, if we were to be involved in a conflict on the ground. So I would perhaps continue research on that. But in terms of a national anti-missile system, I wouldn't bother pursuing, because I don't think the technology is going to work in the first place. And to get it to work, if at all possible, would require hundreds of billions of dollars, more than what we've already spent. As I said, we spent $150 billion so far, and we have nothing to show for it. And after a while, you just have to say that you're pouring money into a hole in the ground. And, you know, I'm surprised that more people haven't said that already. But I really feel that a lot of the proponents of this system are just wedded to it because Ronald Reagan wanted it. And Ronald Reagan's, basically, all the policies he wanted have been implemented at this point, with the exception of this one system. So it's just kind of like, you know, they're paying homage to Ronald Reagan or something. You know, it's like a religious mantra. Either that, or you have people who really want to spread U.S. dominance, military dominance, and this is one way to do it.
With more on the story, I spoke with Peter Lumsdaine, a coordinator of the Vandenberg Action Coalition. Peter spent 18 months in federal prison for the 1992 destruction of a Navistar Global Positioning System satellite. We spoke as the U.S. was announcing its decision to withdraw from the ABM Treaty. He begins with the implications of that decision.
Bush, I think, announced something that a lot of people in arms control circles, in the general public, in Russia, in many other countries, had been expecting to some degree for a while, because actually even under Clinton there were noises in the same direction, and Bush had made that more explicit, but nobody was sure exactly when he would make the formal announcement, and I suppose some people weren't even sure if he would actually go ahead with this rather watershed change, but he's now announced it. I mean, it comes at a very interesting time, you know, in terms of this current major conflict that's going on between the U.S. and various underground organizations in the Middle East and Southwest Asia and so forth, and not only the United States, but also obviously Great Britain and other countries that have allied themselves to one degree or another with the U.S. So that's, you know, certainly a context for this announcement. And I suspect that one of the reasons that Bush did it now was because he felt that there was enough international momentum lined up behind the United States, that, including from the Russian government, that the consequences of this wouldn't be as drastic as they might be at other times. And it also comes at an interesting point because, obviously, Bush and Putin have just met in Washington, D.C. and Texas and announced these supposedly major cuts in strategic offensive nuclear weapons arsenals. That, however, is now, I think, really in question, because now that he's actually not just talking about it, but he's gone ahead and announced, yes, we're pulling out of the ABM treaty, which is seen by many people, not only in Russia, but also in Europe and in the United States as a basic underpinning of strategic nuclear stability in the modern world, that puts everything in a different context, and it's hard to say what the Russian government will do. Frankly, I was a bit skeptical of those announced U.S. and Russian strategic arms cuts anyway, and I think this just casts additional doubt over them.
Bush has referred often recently to the attacks of September 11th as reason to deploy this. Do you think that the war against terrorism is a valid justification for the deployment of this? I mean, my opinion is that, you know, the attacks we saw on September 11th prove that missile defense is kind of pointless if somebody really wants to attack the U.S., but I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, I'm not sure I completely agree with either you or George Bush. I think that, you know, when people say that September 11th showed that missile defense system won't work, doesn't have value, I don't think that's entirely true. I think what it does show is that there are very serious, in fact, catastrophic attacks, even more drastic than September 11th, which could be launched against the United States even if this missile defense system were fully in place. And that is an important point, because if people think this is some kind of foolproof dome of protection over the United States, it's not going to be, even if the thing could be gotten to work the way it's supposed to. Obviously, it wouldn't have stopped September 11th or other unconventional attacks of that kind. So that is an important point. On the other hand, there's a specific kind of attack which is a potentially very serious threat to any country, including the United States, which the system is designed to protect against, which is a government that has a small number, but some, intercontinental ballistic missiles that could launch one or a few of these at a distant country like the United States. And technically, if the system could be gotten to work, it could provide some measure of protection from that. I mean, the examples that are often given are Iraq, or North Korea, Iran, so forth and so on. So that's true to a degree insofar as it goes. Of course, one of the big questions is, will this thing ever be able to work? Although I think that argument is actually overemphasized by the peace movement. But I think the other two questions that are really more fundamental, one is, why would a national state launch a ballistic missile attack, which, unlike, you know, a hidden smuggled bomb, can be definitely tracked? We've got a huge missile tracking telemetry system. We're going to know where that thing came from. And the result is going to be that their country, as a functioning government, probably as a functioning national entity, is going to be annihilated from the face of the earth. If they launch a atom bomb on a intercontinental ballistic missile or a huge nerve gas weapon or something into an American city, they're going to be, whether this is right or whether it's not right, the fact of the matter is they're going to be wiped from the map. So why would they do that? You can be as edgy and kind of crazy and tyrannical and anti-American as you want to be. A national state government is not going to do it. And, of course, that is the principle of deterrence, right? Balance of terror, mutual assured destruction, which supposedly kept the Soviet Union under Stalin and others at bay from attacking the United States, Maoist China, and so forth, and supposedly kept the U.S. generals and war promoters, extreme anti-communists, at bay from launching such an attack against the Soviet Union for years and years and years and decades. And that still holds true. In fact, it's even more true now, because there is no question. You know, we're not talking about the Soviet Union. We're talking about a small country with a few missiles, and they would be wiped out. But the other thing, I think, and this is the reason that China, for instance, and Russia are so jumpy about this thing, is that these systems have always been, since the 1950s, the anti-ballistic missile systems, the concept, was put in place at least 40 years before September 11th. These systems have always been oriented towards being a component that would work in conjunction with U.S. offensive nuclear forces. And it is not just a paranoid speculation. It is actually a circumstantially and directly documented fact of U.S. strategic doctrine and policy that we have always reserved the right to strike first with nuclear weapons. And the only way that you can credibly do that against another major nuclear armed power is to make sure that they don't retaliate, or there's no significant retaliation, or no major retaliation, or very limited retaliation. So you can read the strategic doctrine, U.S. War College, all this stuff, Pentagon documents that have been leaked, that have been declassified, that the people who wrote them, like Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, who wrote the first strategic war plan for the Pentagon in 1961, have talked about, that this is a component of U.S. strategy, and of course it's very, very destabilizing, and any other major country like Russia or China is very jumpy, because it removes, potentially, it removes that deterrent that neither side can shoot first because they'll be hammered in return, with the idea that actually we could win a strategic nuclear war, that we could win World War III by starting it, by shooting first and knocking out everything the other side has on the ground, which is what our weapons are oriented to do, and then catch most of the residual, ragged remaining retaliation, a few missiles that might get off the ground with this anti-ballistic missile system. That's why China and Russia are so jumpy about this thing, and a lot of the Europeans are so jumpy about it, and a lot of the people who understand this concern about nuclear stability in the United States are so jumpy about it.
Since the fall of the Soviet Union, there's huge stockpiles supposedly not being monitored too carefully, and also now rising tensions between Pakistan and India. India, in fact, yep. today just made the first moves to test a long-range missile.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on this? In your opinion, what can be done to secure these stockpiles?
That is a very key question. I mean, Time magazine just ran a major story this past week about the nuclear pipeline, smuggled nuclear materials over and so on. I think that is something which concerns people from the military-industrial corporate leadership all the way to left-leaning grassroots activists. So that's a common concern, and I think that really this is a function to a large degree of the incredible economic and social decline of society inside of the former USSR, which is not to promote or necessarily compliment the Soviet government that much, but the fact is that since the Soviet government collapsed and was replaced with this kind of post-Soviet Russian Federation and then these spin-off states like Kazakhstan and Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan and all of these different countries that have emerged, you know, the infrastructure has really crumbled, and that has affected everything from the health of the people, where life expectancy is actually declining in many of these areas, and major public health disaster, not only because of the legacy of the Soviet Union, which of course the capitalist ideologues or Cold War ideologues or whatever like to point out, like, oh, this is the terrible legacy of the Soviet Union. Well, to some degree that is true, because the Soviet Union, even more probably even more than the United States, and that's saying some, has left this vast trail of, you know, nuclear and chemical garbage across the landscape and so forth and so on. But it's interesting that those declines happened, you know, really kicked in when these countries were supposedly liberated from the burden of oppressive, inefficient socialist bureaucracy and turned over to the tender mercies of free market international capitalism. So that's interesting, you know, but there is a whole infrastructure decline that's happened there. And with that, of course, there's been a kind of ragged collapse of large portions of the Soviet security state, which was massive. So you have low-paid, disillusioned, probably substance-abusing, vodka-abusing, you know, security guards watching over this crumbling system. Now, the Russian government realizes that, yeah, this is a top priority. They don't want this stuff getting loose either. So I think it's not quite as out of control as some people think, because what limited resources they have, they do. And the U.S. has kicked in money and advisors and so on to try and secure these areas. But the fact is, I don't think that either the Russian government or the American government has put sufficient resources into really keeping on top of this stuff. And so, you know, the cat may already be out of the bag to a certain degree. Of course, there's also the question, too, of, I don't mean to minimize this problem of loose nukes or loose nuclear material, and I think it is a serious problem. And, you know, I don't want Al-Qaeda or whoever, you know, getting a hold of a bunch of plutonium or weapons-grade uranium or this kind of stuff. But on the other hand, it's like the poster, you know, that has appeared in various forms, like the government warns us that technology of mass destruction may fall into unreliable, irresponsible, abusive, violent hands. It already has theirs, right? So the ruling governments of the world, China, Russia, Britain, France, the United States, you know, have shown ample willingness to kill large numbers of people, both indirectly and directly, often using these powerful technologies. So I think that we really, the biggest threat by far right now, even beyond India and Pakistan and this loose nuclear material, the biggest threat by far in and of itself is these enormous strategic nuclear arsenals that the United States and the Russian government have maintained, which are truly at apocalyptic levels. Even if all of Bush's proposed cuts were carried out, they would remain by far the largest arsenals on the planet.
What are our stockpiles currently? 6,000?
6 or 7,000 strategic
long-range
nuclear weapons. Yeah, strategic missiles mean basically long-range intercontinental nuclear weapons that can either be fired from submerged submarines or surface submarines or from long-range bombers and intercontinental missiles. And it's interesting, too, when if you really look at the fine print into the New York Times and really look at paragraph 14 or whatever, what Bush actually said, and I don't particularly fault the press on this, it's just like, you know, you have to look at the fine print, and it is in there. The way he described this approximately 2,000 warhead level was, I think he said, operationally deployed strategic nuclear weapons. So that's not counting tactical nuclear weapons, which are on shorter range systems, even though they might be forward based, let's say on F-18s on aircraft carriers halfway around the world. And it's also not counting what they call the strategic reserve, where they have weapons that are held in reserve, which could, however, potentially be brought back into operation pretty quickly. There is a major loophole here in terms of shorter range delivery systems and in terms of reserve weapons. I mean, it's been said for many years that India and perhaps Pakistan and India at a certain point could claim that they didn't have nuclear weapons. It became kind of a joke. It's like, well, yeah, they're three turns of a screwdriver away from it. In other words, they've got all of the components there, and all they have to do is snap them together, and they've got the weapons. So it's kind of like that to a certain degree with our so-called strategic reserve. So granted, yeah, the reduction from 6,000 or 7,000 to 2,000, 2,500, somewhere in there, if that's carried out, yeah, it's definitely a major step in the right direction, but it still leaves even those numbers at such a high level that it's almost unimaginable in terms of the destructive power, and there's all these thousands of weapons in reserve ready to be rushed into service should the need arise. However, I think that it's, frankly, it's questionable whether we're ever going to get to those 2,000 warhead levels under the current administration, by which I don't just mean Bush or Bush and Putin, but I mean the current dominant forces, let's say, in the U.S. And Russian government, because, among other things, of this whole mess with the anti-ballistic missile treaty, the ABM treaty.
Now, how has the U.S. been able to thus far carry out these tests? They've done five in the past 2 years, three quote-unquote successes. What are the provisions of the ABM treaty currently that allow the U.S. to sort of build this thing, essentially?
They've been doing these tests for decades, actually. You know, we've watched old newsreel footage from the 50s and 60s about these tests. And again, it was Vandenberg Air Force Base on the coast of California and Kwajalein Atoll in the South Central Pacific that were the two ends of this test range. The technologies have changed, but the idea hasn't really changed much over those decades, and they've never got a really comprehensive working system. So they can do the tests. They're allowed to do the tests, and Russia is also allowed to do tests. But what they're not allowed to do is to deploy a system that would defend more than a very small area. There's one area of the country under the ABM which the national government can choose that can be defended, but the comprehensive defense of the national territory isn't allowed, and that even goes to the extent of radars that would be specifically designed. And again, this often gets into a gray area with both the Soviet government in the past, the U.S. government now, so on. You know, when does a missile tracking radar become a missile defense radar, and so forth and so on. But there are certain thresholds. And so, for instance, in Alaska, they're planning to build, this would be one of the first steps, is this new radar system there and pouring the concrete and setting up the facility. So they can do the tests, but the tests will move into a more operational full-scale level and probably a greater frequency, and they will start moving towards deployment steps as well if this thing goes forward.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California. And portions of this program can also be heard on Suppressed Truths on KZUU 90.7 FM in Pullman, Washington. The interviews featured in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all, 24 hours a day, listen online. Listen online at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to frsc@microradio.net. That's frsc@microradio.net or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Or call area code 831-427-4523. That's 831-427-4523. Thanks to the A-Info's Radio Project for distribution. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For Old Lady Scar Arms and everyone here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.